Blog Talk Radio.
As the tears are falling from my face, with all my fears I long for your embrace. How am I gonna carry on and be the one you leave?
Back home from the fight, that old flag.
flag was stitched with more than blue and white, but we turned our eyes when the eagle calling names, and something changed within his eyes. He didn't look the same. He hid his wounds from battle, so others didn't know. But he couldn't hide the damage of their scars upon his soul. There was no love for the soldier limping back home from the fight. That old flag was stitched with more than blue and white, but we turned our eyes when the eagle
Jay Billington, called The Eagle Cried. And, you know, they were both very beautiful, touching songs. And we're coming into the Memorial Day weekend. So let me explain to you about Memorial Day. Memorial Day is not Veterans Day. It's not a day to thank us for our service. It's not a joyous celebratory day. It is a day to honor those that sacrificed their lives in defense of this country. And many of us that have been around long enough, we all know somebody or have someone in our family or friends that made that ultimate sacrifice. And you know, no matter how dressed it up, it's still in a pain. It's still an incredible pain that never goes away. And we do a lot of things to honor those deceased members of armed forces who laid it all on the line. You know, 400,000 plus died in World War II. We lost over 50,000 in Korea and 55,000 and 58,000 in Vietnam. And we've lost thousands in other wars since. So it is a humble time. It's a time for us to reflect and really look at things. And they called it Decoration Day. And my friend Rich Kilblain just pointed out that it actually started with honoring the Confederate dead, because many of them were, you know, obviously they lost the Civil War. And, you know, however you paint it, they still fought for what they believed in, and many of them died. And they had mothers and they had fathers, and we should never trample on the graves or take any pleasure in the death of other people. What you see going on in the country right now, tearing down statues, desecrating cemeteries of Confederate dead, is just Satan. Just Satan acting through people. And I'm going to tell you why. Because Satan absolutely does not want you to educate the future generations on the wickedness or the bad things that happened in the past. So you just tear everything down and you make it all rosy and pretty again. And you just tell everybody, this is the way you live, until somebody else rises up, another Hitler, another Mussolini, another Jefferson Davis, however you want to paint those guys. But I can tell you this, that we are in a bad way right now. And for this Memorial Day weekend, I think that we need to really do some soul searching, America. Stop just throwing your vote away. So we're going to talk a little bit about politics. We're going to talk a little bit about Memorial Day and its historical significance. But more importantly, how are we going to truly honor those who died for our freedom? And I think the least you can do is to make an educated vote and start looking at some of these candidates. Oh, well, he's a Republican. Must be good. Not true. Not true. Shocking, shocking revelations today in West Virginia with two candidates. And look, whether or not you know you like Donald Trump or Rick DeSantis or whatever, you know, whoever you're supporting, good for you. You know, go out and vote your conscience, and then at the end of the day, figure out how to help the one that becomes victorious. But you can't be a hypocrite about it. And I want to talk about a couple of things here. Number one, I'm pro-life. I am 100% pro-life. I'm a Christian. I follow Jesus Christ, and I won't ever apologize for that. And neither should you if you do the same. Because the deal is that same freedom that is allowing BLM to protest and is allowing trans people to dance half naked on the street, then, you know, I at least have the freedom, extended to me in my faith. Now, I know that we've went through some bad presidents. Barack Obama, I'm telling you what, we need to, if we could bring Richard Nixon back, I think America owes that man an apology. Between Obama, who created this disaster we have in office now, and really that's not true either, because Obama was smoking weed with Michael whenever Joe Biden first came into office. But Joe Biden and his crime family has done more to destroy this country than the Confederacy. And I surely hope that all of you that are tearing down these statues of the Confederacy will turn around and do the same thing to those that are going to be erected for Barack Obama and Joe Biden. Because they've destroyed the dang country. It's dang, D-A-N-G, okay? They destroyed the dang country. Your taxes are out the roof. You can't go anywhere. Black on white violence, black on Asian violence, violence against people not of color has risen 85%. I know, I'm a bigot, I'm a racist, I'm a white extremist because I'm telling you that. Just go turn on the news. And if you're part of a population that represents only 13% of America, but you are perpetrating 70 to 85% of the crime, then we have a problem. And if that problem is poverty, then I agree, we need to address it. We need to address it. If that problem is you not being able to get a job, then we need to address it. If people are not hiring you because of your race, your religion, I don't care. If you're an American citizen, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, it does not matter. An American, if you're an American citizen and you're upholding our laws, but if it's because you have a criminal record, 40-some arrest for assault and battery, then I'm sorry, I don't think I'm willing to take the chance on hiring you. If you're 20-some years old and you've already racked up 40 felonious assaults in your life, I mean, who's protecting my business, my organization? Does that make me a racist or a bigot, or does that make me a smart businessman because I've decided, you know what I mean, to exercise my right to run my business as I see fit and appropriately? Freedom does not exist as it used to exist. Barack Obama has created the racial division in this country. I mean, Jeremiah Wright, that's all I need to say. He sat in Jeremiah Wright's church, not because he loved Jesus, but because he believed everything that that man said. And he continued to stand by Reverend Jeremiah Wright when he said to GD America, right from the pulpit. Unbelievable. We have an attack on faith, we have attack on people because of their race. And I'm seeing adults. I saw an adult woman, African-American woman, adult, grab a child about 9 years old by the hair and punch her right in the face in a school with teachers and students around. The poor child just laid down. Why? Why are we not arresting these people and putting them in under the prison? Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm with the thought of Jesus Christ, that whosoever harms the hair of a little one, may there be a millstone tied around their neck. They just as well have a millstone tied around their neck and be cast into the sea. It's unbelievable what's going on in this country. And you know what's a shame? You know, let me tell you what's a shame. It's not all 14% of the black population, because I have great friends that happen to be people of color. Lots of great friends that I would shed blood with on the battlefield, that to this day they could call me, I'd call them. We tell each other we love each other and we mean it. We love their kids and we support each other. And they tell me all the time, I don't know why these people are going crazy. It's not all of us. It's only about 1%. So you got 1% of that population, creating 90% or 75%. I can't remember what it was, the crime rate. I go look it up. But you go look it up. Then you have illegal immigration. And I'm not talking about people that are really trying to get away from a bad situation. You know, I can sympathize with those folks. Being of Irish descent and having friends on here of Italian and German descent and who and wherever else that you're from, you know, people escape tyranny. So I have great compassion for those folks. But what we are seeing now is more men crossing the border now from China, from all over the place. And I'm talking young, strong men, not poor, innocent women and children. They have invaded America. There was a movie made back in the 80s that talked about this very, very thing. And it talked about, and it was a corny movie, but it was basically they finally got together and they rose up. It's a hatred. Hatred. And I'm telling you, it's, you know, I've just got to be very honest with you. I'm seeing more violence being perpetrated on innocent, helpless people that happen to be white. I just watched a video of a very healthy African-American man just beating the tar out of an old 75-year-old man in a nursing home. Now, the charges were dropped against him, but he had schizophrenia, so they're keeping him in some mental health facility. And maybe he did. I don't know. But he videotaped the whole thing. My question is how did that place hire him? Why did they hire him? It took them a while to fire him, too. I mean, why are we afraid to just hold people accountable? I'll tell you why. Because this administration has totally bent over and in all ways for these fanatical groups of zealots. The trans community represents less than 1% of America. The people that are perpetrating violent crime, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, I don't care what color you are a criminal, and you should be treated accordingly. Justice wears a blindfold, except for today. In this day and age, the blindfold comes up. Now, you know I was totally against the January 6th event, totally against that. I think that was a waste of energy and a waste of effort. But I am appalled and sickened by the fact that they just convicted the leader of Oath Keepers, who I didn't like him either. But he's still an American citizen. Convicted him and going to put him in jail. An Obama-appointed African-American judge going to put him in jail for 18 years. 18 years? Never shot nobody, never killed nobody. But yet you had a guy like George Floyd out walking the street. Been arrested, put in jail. Held a woman that was pregnant at gunpoint with a gun pointing towards that unborn child. It was wrong that they killed him. The cops got exactly what they deserved. But, as my good friend just reminded me, his biggest crime, he put his feet on Pelosi's desk. We know we don't do that. Wonder what's going to happen to the guy, to Pelosi's husband's friend, that hit him with the hammer. That's what I'm wondering. I got to bring Rich and them on here. We got to find out about that. I ain't heard nothing about that in a while. What about that guy? What about that guy? That guys that came into Pelosi's house? You don't hear much about that fella anymore, do you?
He got inducted into the Carpenters Union.
What? Oh my goodness. Well, you know, there was something so bizarre about that whole thing. But I haven't heard anything about this guy. Is he in jail? He's got to be in jail. They probably took him to a special jail, you know, where, you know, he can be tortured and you don't get to see what's happening to him. Maybe he went to that island that they keep talking about, you know, Bill Clinton and all of them went to. I don't know. Thoughts? Thoughts on anything I said coming up? I came in a little bit hard tonight, and so we talked.
Right.
But go ahead.
I'll address the last two points you talked about, which is the I think it's an 18-year sentence for the leader of the Oath Takers and Oath Keepers and George Floyd. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The greatest threat to America today is white extremism. That is the greatest terrorist threat. There you go. Okay.
You go ride the subway.
The reason is because white extremists target individuals they see as the blame for the problems. Whereas extremists burn down neighborhoods, harass people at their homes or in public places. So they're not a great threat. Burning down city blocks is not an act of terrorism. But you piss off the extreme right, they will hunt you down and kill you. So they are the greatest threat. So now keep in mind, we had in Tennessee, remember, a bunch of gun control advocates took over the House, all right? And three of the congressional reps, stood with them. Two were kicked out. One wasn't because she didn't really do anything. And then, of course, they were reinstated. But that's okay. That's okay. Well, the thing is, what the courts are trying to send a message is white extremism is the greatest terrorist threat, and you will know that by the extremity of the punishment, and that attacking the national capital is a heinous crime. Okay, that's what they're sending a message that you can't storm the capital. Now, you can storm state capitals, and you're okay.
Yeah,
that's what the Black Panthers actually got their start by walking in armed to a state meeting, okay? At the state level, it's okay, but not at the national level. That's what the message is, okay? And because it's white extremism.
Yeah.
Now, as far as George Floyd, okay? Yeah, you hit it. It was wrong. It was wrong that they killed him. But I can tell you something my Latin wife told me after that. Okay? Latins have too much pride to make a martyr out of a convicted felon.
Right.
Just think about that. Okay?
Sure.
And I thought, reflected on that. I'm like, why are the – I mean, it's one thing to say – this cop was bad.
Mm-hmm.
But the counter to it is, no, this man was good. The bad cop killed a good man. No, the bad cop killed a bad man.
Yeah.
But the message is, now I'm beginning to understand the message. He was a victim. He's a good man because he's a victim. His problems were not his problems. His problems are because he's a victim. Reparations. Reparations is because all descendants of blacks who have never been slaves are victims. They can't get ahead because they're victims. We live in a age of victimhood, okay? So that's my comments on the last two things you stated.
Well, Father Michael?
Well, I think we've seen gangsters lifted up as heroes. From Al Capone to El Chapo. And, I think there's a false sense of what compassion is. As I listen to people, and as Rich was talking about, you know, victimhood, And, you know, I grew up in the projects in North New Jersey where I was a minority, okay? And I really think that it is an insult. I have several friends that are highly, highly educated African-Americans.
Yeah.
And because of a lot of the reparations, and as I said earlier, you know, if you don't have an education, give free education. Make that a reparation. You can put an extra kid in a class at college and you know, tutor them along or whatever. But when you make it seem like no black can make it because they're a victim, mm-hmm. and, you know, either one of my parents graduated high school. My mother didn't even graduate eighth grade. And I just think it's an insult for those who have worked so hard. And I know people, one who went to Barnard College, she was in my church, another one who was a lawyer, a JAG in the Navy, another one who's a chief scientist at Johns Hopkins University, started as an E6 in the Army, and they're looked upon suspiciously by others who think they got there because they were pushed ahead. So I think sometimes it's an insult. I've gone kind of off the railroad with my students who intimate because you're poor, you're a criminal. Because I grew up poor, and I don't think there's a correlation there. I don't think if you've been given good values, you know, about working that, you know. Now listen, begging is more honorable than stealing, but
sure.
I resent the fact, you know, and I know my Italian heritage in America, you know, wasn't a glorious thing. They brought terrorism. There's no question about it, you know, through the mafia. But I don't think that just because you have a low start, you know, my grandfather came over here from Italy. He stayed a year, went back and got my grandmother and two children. And he worked in a factory, worked as a garbage man. He owned a three-family house. A big two-family house. And I just think that it's an insult to think that just because something happened years ago that you don't have a chance. And if you feed people that lie, then we're always making excuses. But, you know, there will be a day of judgment. St. Paul, when he talked to one of the kings, he talked about self-control and the judgment to come. I see so much injustice and people seemingly getting away with things. But let me tell you something. It's not a threat. But Jesus has eyes like a flame of fire. No BSing him at the end. And so he will balance the books. And, you know, we're living in a terrible, terrible time where right is wrong and wrong is right. And I really feel sorry for our country. I've seen it go downhill, you know, and, you know, being a Vietnam vet and being – in the crazy 60s, you know, we thought that was the wackiest time, but I'll tell you, it's even worse now.
Right.
Well, I'm not, I mean, it is gloomy to see what's going on in these major cities throughout America, but it's not all the big cities, and it's not all the states. It's pretty much the cities and states that are run by Democrats. What we have is some great social experiments, and I'm grateful for that. I'm like, California, do that. Do that. Pay reparations. Do that. Let's see how it turns out, okay? Whereas in other states, no, we're still maintaining, you know, office of law and order is to protect the innocent people and businesses, okay, to maintain civility. You know, what I think aggravating us is what we see going on in New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, or all the West Coast major cities. So I don't think it's widespread. Now, the problem we have is with the national government is the weaponization of three departments that have become arms of the Democratic Party. And I mean, that's what the Durham report, well, I don't think the Durham report went into the IRS, but we've already seen that. So essentially what what we were learning is that the DOJ, the FBI, and the IRS have become, arms of the Democratic Party. However they worked it out, appointing the right people, let it slip underneath the nose of the Republican Party. But that's what it's become. And so, they have a nationwide reach that, that's bothersome.
Well, the FBI has been involved in this since J. Edgar Hoover. This is not new with them weaponizing their positions to hold, to basically control politicians. That I don't think is a secret, but the IRS.
Actually, you're right. I would say I'm not surprised because of J. Edgar Hoover. There is a culture within the FBI of maintaining power and being involved in politics. Whereas with the military, up until Clinton, the military has always tried to be apolitical. All right. And it goes back to Washington, and that is the idea because of the Cromwellian fear of martial law, that we have an inherent fear of the military taking over. And so Washington, always made sure that our military subordinated itself to the civilian government, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that has become a longstanding tradition. However, what a lot of people don't realize is there was a purge during the Clinton administration. And essentially what happened was most presidents have just really, as far as I remember, have left the Army alone. But when Bill Clinton took over, all these generals we were watching that were rising stars started resigning. And they were resigning because they knew their careers were over, okay? And all of a sudden, we started getting political appointees. And Wesley Clark was one of them, okay?
Sure.
Let's look at the flag officers that are all of a sudden getting out and now being talking heads on all these news outlets, okay? It begins with Wesley Clark. Not before.
Sure.
Before anyone was consulted for their opinion or something, but they're not on hire. Okay. So, and you have your reservations about the recent, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Okay. But they're all political appointees that are basically pushing the political agenda. The military is being, I wouldn't say weaponized, but right now it's really going woke, and that's why it's suffering from recruiting.
So segregation in World War II, we've all seen that. We've all witnessed that. And there was a lot of really bad things that happened. But let me ask you, what's really different today? Because we're seeing, I know I've got kids that have been in, and I'm seeing people that have went in and are getting out because of some of the things that are happening, especially in the Army, where
right.
You're a black female. And you can stand up and cuss your first sergeant out in front of everybody.
Right.
Terrible.
How
does that happen?
Okay. Let me walk through. All right. So when I taught history to the lieutenants, especially when I had like all day to do it, there was one class where I had a class on, why we study history, and I would address the role of minorities. And of course I would ask, the blacks, are you interested in the history of your race in the Army? And of course they would. Now this was a setup for a segue to, cause we look at how far they've come. And if you take a snapshot in time, if you look at an incident, where blacks have been marginalized or whatever, or prevented from rising up, you will see, like, the Army's racist. And I'm like, no, but if you look at it from the context, from the beginning to the end, what you see is when we came to America, we embraced the Enlightenment, the ideas that all men are created equal. It's just, you know, we were bringing this baggage we had from Europe. And so not everybody, you know, it's like, yes, we want to embrace this idea that all men are created equal, except the fact that, well, we don't think all men are equal. And it's going to take us a while to, Michelle and I joke about it all the time. I mean, the Irish, you know, the Irish were one step below the Scots, and the Scots, you know, and one step above the Indians, okay, and the African Americans, all right? And they were so grateful when the Italians arrived because now they finally had someone to look down upon, okay? Yeah, but hey, it was, what was it? It was the archbishop that said, hey, you guys got to stop fighting. You got more in common, okay? You got, and then they started marrying, and the Irish became hitmen for the mafia. Okay, so they fixed it. Huh? So anyway, no, you know, we get to the point where it's like, you know, when we had all this racism going on. Okay, Obama, look, seriously, we've made so, African Americans have made such progress in this country that we elected our first black president. And I didn't like him because he had no legislative experience and he was from Chicago. He's anti-gun. Okay. I couldn't vote for Mitt Romney. Okay. I couldn't vote for Mitt Romney because he's governor of Massachusetts, which is anti-gun. Okay. He made, you know, he may change his opinion. No, no. You were the governor of the most restrictive state before it comes to gun control. Okay. So, I'm like, we've done it. So all I'm thinking to myself that, you know, any any impoverished black going, well, you know, my problem is, you know, you're holding me down. I'm like, look at this guy. Look how far he went. Okay, if he can be the president, you can go. You know, what was it? When I grew up, when you and I grew up, we were taught any one of us can become the president of the United States.
Sure.
All right. And finally, we get a black man becomes the president of the United States. There it is. It's finally solved. And then Obama goes, when that one kid gets shot, if I had a son, my God, that was it. If, you know, when we get past, those of us who are growing up in this time frame, who've experienced it, we've taken sides, okay? Historians are going to look at this generations later, who are not personally connected to it, are going to bring it down to that one statement, if I had a son. Obama, instead of trying to heal, created division. And that, out of all this, and out of the what was in Missouri? What was that town where the kid got? You know, he had just robbed a store. Police officer tried to halt him. He attacked the police officer. Police officer
Ferguson,
shooting.
Ferguson, Missouri.
Okay, that's it. All right,
Michael Brown.
The BLM grows out of that. So you can cite all the where we're really coming together, we start growing apart after that statement. Okay.
Can I mention something
about
the hatred? When we saw this adjunct professor from Wagner College in New York attack those pro-life students and then put a machete under the throat, the vitriol, and I'm just telling you, there is a hatred that's been unleashed. And people can say what they want to say about COVID, but there's a violence and there's such hatred. I taught critical thinking and debate, and now I understand you're not allowed to debate and raise certain issues or you have points marked against you.
Sure.
I really think most stuff is driven by hatred, not poverty. I believe there's class issues more than there are race issues because of the whole money situation. But I'm just astonished at how quickly a person will snap and, you know, be ready to kill somebody or slit someone's throat. This has got to be harnessed, or we're going to be less civilized people and become brutes, become animals.
Mm-hmm. All right. On that note, if you're worried about being attacked by the whatever side, the extreme right or extreme left, you need to get involved in martial arts. Hey, here's my chance to plug the martial arts again. Yeah. Okay. Because when you talk about that, having a machete put to your throat, mm-hmm. I can fucking turn that situation around real fast. Okay. Like the guy, the old man, you know, it was New York City, and remember the police were doing what they're supposed to do. They got their little batons, and they're marching forward. They're pushing people away. And so this, 70-year-old, he's an agitator, goes to all these protests and stuff. He gets pushed back, his heel catches, and he falls, and he cracks his skull. Okay, now whose fault is that? Well, of course he's a victim because he's on the left. I'm like, no, look, if you're going to get in fight with somebody, to a martial arts class and learn how to take a roll. Just take a break fall. Learn how to roll unless you want to end up in the hospital, okay? That's my advice to you, okay? If you're going to get in a fight, learn how to fight. If you're going to, you know, want to go against the police and stuff like that, learn how to take a fall on the street.
Yeah, but they're
my
not
wife,
most.
I render the rest of my time to Father Michael.
Let me interject. My wife took a self-defense class at about 70 years old, maybe 69 or whatever. It was before she had a knee replacement. But, you know, the way she grew up, I mean, we grew up very different. And I would say she was more passive or whatever. She loved it. She loved the class. And I think she would, you know, take it again. So it's just a matter of self-awareness. You know, when I was in martial arts, some of the people in my congregation were a little concerned, thinking I was getting my spirituality from there. So at a missions dinner one time, I had explained to them that my spiritual life is all about Jesus, my academic life, and they know the schools that I was attending was feeding my mind. But I was doing it for the physical aspect, and I teased them. I said, to get some frustration out. You know, our church was up to about 200 by the time I left because you aggravate me, you know, just teasing. But I think that we need to be responsible for ourselves and have some kind of confidence.
Yeah, we exist as the mind, the body, and the soul. Okay, and mm-hmm. so religion teaches us, you know, there's many different religions, but they train the soul. Academics mm-hmm. train the mind,
mm-hmm.
but sports, athletics trains the body, okay? And it's funny because I've lost about 10 pounds since I've retired, mm-hmm. and I'm in really good shape. I'm running at least 2 times a day, and plus resistance work and my martial arts. And, you know, I have these pictures on my cell phone of my colleagues. And, I mean, I watch these guys. You know, I worked in the field for 2 decades, and I watch these guys progressively just balloon up, swollen bellies. And I remember the last effort, and I'm like, I looked around, like, all these guys are seriously fat. They weren't fat when I first met them. And my point is, scholars, unfortunately, just focus on only one aspect mm-hmm. of their being, their mind. And let me tell you, and not the whole mind. The mind, when you train in the martial arts, there's actually, the mind functions on 3 levels, the logical part, the rational part, which gets in the way in fighting, the subconscious part, and then the muscle memory, the stem, okay? And the martial arts trains all three aspects of it. But as scholars, we only focus on one aspect, and we let ourselves get so out of shape that now we have all these health issues.
Yeah. Well, no, I taught in the Army, and I the importance of total fitness. And I would tell the soldiers, you need to be physically proficient, physically fit, especially when I was at Fort Bragg, and professionally competent. But then spiritually and ethically fit as well, because I've seen many people shoot themselves in the foot. They were great in PT. They were great professionally on their jobs, but they were moral midgets. And I'm sorry to use that terminology. It's not meant to be derogatory, but they had not developed. They were morally challenged because it's an intangible area that they never developed. And so they were still juvenile.
No. Okay, let's get into that because I'm going to give you a couple examples. All right. So I was in Honduras, my second mission down there. It was a long one. I think I did 5 months down there, and there was a lot of corruption going on. I'd already been warned about it, and I was in 2nd Battalion, 7th Special Forces, and this was the 1st Battalion mission. At 2nd, but the 1st Battalion was whining because no one wanted to do this mission. It had a bad reputation, and so 1st Bat, was whining that they didn't want to send their good officers down there. So they complained to group that they didn't have enough Spanish-speaking officers to go down there. And so my battalion offered me up. I just got back from a mission, turn around. I joke about it. They drugged my butt kicking and screaming on that plane. I went down there. And so I did not identify. There was augmentees. About half the people were augmentees, which is native speakers but non-SF, and then there was the SF guys. And the SF guys looked down on the augmentees. And, of course, the augmentees looked down on the SF guys because the only thing they had going for them is that tab, okay? So not all of them were good, and especially the leadership they sent down there was really bad. So I had very little to do with them, and we ended up getting into conflict with them. And there was one captain, he was the intel officer. And when it got so bad, someone leaked, one of the lieutenants wrote back to a classmate of his about the corruption going on. It led to an investigation. They sent a 15-6 officer down there. And so we all had to decide what we were going to say. I'm saying, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to tell them everything I know. The problem is when I went in and I told them what I knew about, he said, have you seen that? I said, no, but I know where it is. He goes, but you haven't seen that. I said, no. He said, then it counts. Okay. But the one guy, the S2, he knew all the dirt and he denied everything. Fear of punishment.
Wasn't morally developed.
There you go. There you go. That's exactly what he was. He was young. I ran into him several years later, and he saw me, and he came up to me. He goes, Rich, I want to tell you, you did the right. He said, I've been regretting that all my life. He said, you did the right thing. You stood up for what you believed was right. Even though you liked the colonel and stuff like that, you stood up. I said, well, it didn't help me out any. I said, but he said he had wrestled with that. Because the thing is, you can't go back and change that. Mm-hmm. You may suffer the consequences for doing the right thing, but you get to go through the rest of life knowing you did the right thing. Okay? Right. You have that satisfaction. Okay? You may have suffered for it, but the guys who compromised. Now, the problem is that for him, he realized he had done wrong. Now, the people who continue to compromise, that's the people, that's the politician James is criticizing. Those people have compromised so much they have no moral compass anymore. Okay, right. That's what that's it right. leads to.
Yep. No, and you know, it's habituation, and like Aristotle says, it's internalization. It happens by practice, depending on how you were raised and what choices you've made throughout your life. When push comes to shove, and that could be to any kind of temptation, if you know, found a dime on the floor and you asked if anyone dropped it, you know, if you told the truth in a small situation or resisted a temptation in a small situation, that's just like lifting weights. That's how you become morally fit when push comes to shove, when you really have a major decision to make. It doesn't happen overnight or by osmosis by going into theater and think you're going to turn into Mother Teresa. You know, it's a life of habit. And I think of the warrant officer Thompson during the My Lai massacre. And, you know, there's certain things you just know deep in your heart that are not right, but you've made small decisions. Remember when we were kids, the commercial about the litter, and they had the Native American with the tear, talked about one little paper,
yeah.
You know, thrown, but then it...
Yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah, but I want to interject something. He actually was not Native American. He was Italian. He masqueraded as an Indian. Look him up, but it's true.
Yeah, like some of the wrestlers when we grew up. They weren't Indians. They were Italians.
Yeah.
That's funny. But what I'm saying is that you don't just all of a sudden do the right thing. It is when I would observe other people who taught ethics. I was at a police chaplain's conference. And, you know, check the block, check the block, check the block. No, it's a life of habit. And it comes natural because you've trained your moral self, the intangible things you cannot see, and you will do. You know, when I was away for a year, you know, I'm a priest, but I'm not a monk. But if you haven't resisted temptation like we do when we lift weights, when push comes to shove, you're not going to be able. You're going to cave in. There's a lot of people that I've met are weak-willed because they never exercise their will so that it's strengthened.
Mm-hmm. So
let me throw something out. Okay, Steve. No one knows how they're going to perform under fire. No one knows. My brother, who's
your training doesn't kick in.
Training
doesn't kick in.
It depends on no. It does.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not a coward.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not a coward, it kicks in and mm-hmm. you just start performing.
Mm-hmm.
You start doing like you. All right. But then again, but James can testify to this. We can go back to the Battle of Biop, where, you know, when I interviewed, like, there are several hundred truck drivers hiding behind their trucks. There's videos of them hiding, cowering behind their trucks. There's some that set up a gun wall behind, you know, 100 yards back, but only about a dozen truck drivers went up to the wall to defend it. And Tom Stewart was one of them. And I remember he asked me, he said, he got a Bronze Star out of it. His company did a good job and made sure everybody got decorated who went to the wall. And he said, Rich, you know, I didn't do anything. He said, I did nothing heroic. He said, you think I deserve the Bronze Star? I said, Tom, when you were running towards the wall, first of all, oh, he said, when you were running towards the wall, did you look around left and right? He goes, yeah. And he said, what'd you see? He goes, a lot of people run in the other direction.
Mm.
I said, didn't you think something was wrong here? He's going, look, we're being attacked. He goes, our place is on the wall defending ourselves. And that's when I finally figured it out. Warriors don't do risk assessment. They only ask one thing, what's the right thing to do? But out of several hundred truck drivers, only a dozen people thought that same way. And so
are they trained in the same way as the infantry? I'm not talking about basic training on the range. I'm just talking about.
No. Let me point this out. Okay. That's a very good question because I brought that up. Okay. The combat support and service support, that's your transportation people, only had enough ammunition qualified. That's firing 40, you get, what, so many rounds to zero, and 40 rounds are qualified, and that's all the ammunition allocation they had for the year. Whereas infantry guys have to qualify two times a year and get so much blank ammunition that they go out and pop caps all the time. So those truck drivers were wholly untrained for the challenges that were facing them in Iraq. But anyway, we get back to the moral courage. And that is that you have all these little challenges that you face throughout the life. The thing is, you don't know. When you get in that situation where you have to decide, if I do the right thing, my career can come to an end. What am I going to do? That's the question. And see, at one point, we're taught to, do the harder right than the easier wrong.
I don't agree with that. That's the whole reason I wrote my book about virtue. That is an excuse.
Wait, you don't agree with what?
Okay.
You don't agree that you don't know what you're going to do.
That you don't.
I guarantee it. No, I disagree with you on that.
But there's a history. Thousands of years.
I read your book.
Well, let me talk.
Go ahead.
There's thousands of years of the whole thing with virtue, ethics, and internalization.
Right.
What happened in Vietnam with the conditioning, because people were shooting in the wars before and they weren't hitting their target until they went through the conditioning. And I'm not saying you make people robots, but if you're trained, you're training. I'm not saying you're not a human any longer, but your training kicks in. Now, if you're a coward, that you're going to get weeded out here or there. But the whole concept of virtue ethics, which is thousands of years old, 3,000 years at least, is like swimming in peanut butter. In other words, you're training, you're not even thinking about it. Your training kicks in. People say that with immoral things. I've counseled hundreds of people. Oh, well, I don't know, I got caught out. No, if you had been training yourself, and I'm not saying that we can't sin and have a weak moment, but I'm saying for the most part, if you've been doing the right thing, it comes natural because you've trained yourself. Just like you, do you have to think about the moves that you do in Aikido? If somebody attacks you, you have to say, wait a minute, let me do this. No, it just comes natural. Your training kicks in. So I don't think that morally, we have to train ourselves morally and keep doing
it over and
over and over again. There's a 3,000-year history of that concept.
I'm going to agree and disagree. All right.
Okay.
I'm going to agree on the standpoint is we put ourselves in the situation. We think it through. We go, if I'm put in this situation, because we do it. It's like James's gun truck company. Every time they came off the field, they would do a after action review of what they did. Okay, what could we do differently? Or they would hear about an ambush that took place, and they would analyze it, said, if we were in that situation, what would we do? Okay, but I'm going to tell you, most people aren't. But that's an advocate for your book that said, you need to train moral courage. You need to train.
Right.
Now,
Aristotle said that you become courageous by doing courageous things.
No, you mentally prepare yourself for it. So you know when you're in that situation, how you're going to perform.
They trained after they realized how this other unit did it. but then you have to train. It's like a football team and a football team practices. You can't just talk about it on the board. You got to keep doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it.
All right.
And
let
then
me
in
point
the game,
this out.
It'll come out.
All right. Let me point this out. So in Honduras, I'd already war gamed this situation.
Mm-hmm.
I already knew. Or let me just ask you. So how do you prepare yourself to make the decision that to do the right thing can end your career, your military career? Right? How do you train yourself to make that decision?
It's not mental. First of all, you're approaching it.
I say
it is. You
mental.
I'm telling you, it's not. I'm telling you that it's you're putting your mind in your heart. It's deeper than mental, okay? And it's habitual, okay? So you've done it. Listen, I have the ability to take the chalice, and when I'm consecrating the body and blood of the Lord, I could throw it on the front row of the people. I have that capacity. But I believe the sacredness of it, and I've done it hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, everything in me would never allow me to do that unless I totally went nuts. So it's not just mental. It's deeper than mental. Like I asked you before, if somebody attacks you, you're not going to say, okay, what move should I make? Right? You're just going to you're going to do what you know to do and not even think about it. Like, am I right or not?
All right. I'm going to say yes. If you keep, all right, in that respect, you are correct. But I'm going to throw something out. That is going to challenge us. All right. So it makes it easier. So if through your life, I'm going to tell you right now, I stood for the right thing, but I haven't always stood for the right thing. I have lied, cheated, and stolen, but I still hold that honor code sacred. But I have lied, cheated, or stolen. Okay. In fact, we got together as captains at the captain's course. We graduate, we come from the ivory tower where a cadet will not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. And then we get out into the real army, and all of a sudden we're finding the officers who were preaching the honor code are now telling us we need to sign our name to this piece of paper to lie about something so we can get this extra piece of equipment.
Because it's external, Rich, not internalized.
Wait, let me finish my story.
Go ahead. Okay.
So I mean, all of a sudden, it's like, all those, captains and majors tell us, like, not lie, cheat, or steal. We get in the Army, and they're telling us, we got to lie, cheat, or steal to accomplish the mission. The thing is, when I talked to all my class, we all tended to agree. We moved that bar. We moved that line. And that is, I will not lie, cheat, or steal for personal gain. But anything to get the mission accomplished is fair game. All right. But the thing is, we moved that bar. It's not we erase it. We moved that bar. Okay, we reevaluate. But what you're saying
in debate,
the thing is
moving the goalpost.
You
didn't
every
cross
day
the line, you moved it.
Go ahead.
I said
go
it's
ahead.
Called moving the goalpost. It's not crossing the line, but you move the line. But see,
right, that's right.
The Bible says don't move the ancient boundaries. So when it becomes relativistic, so when do you not compromise? Look, I understand. You know, when you talk about the mission, you got to get a part, you know, you connive somebody. I get what you're saying. That's not your moral.
Connive?
That's
connive.
A higher.
All of a sudden, my guys show up with an engine block. Sir, ask me no questions. I'll tell you no lie. And I'm like, no. I need to know if this is traceable.
Right.
No,
if I have
they
to
can't
sign for it and pay for it.
Yeah, like,
right?
I just want to know. I just want to know. Can the original owners of this engine trace it?
Right. Now somebody else's books and you'll get charged for it. No, you know, moral relativism, but when we're talking about life and death situations,
let's talk about lions, for instance. We're dealing with
like
Nazi Germany.
Like,
we're talking moral fortitude. Moral
I'm talking. You get somebody knocks on your door and says, "Are you hiding Jews?" Okay. You know, my ancestor, Pius the 12th, saved a lot of Jews. They gave them baptismal papers, made them Catholics, try to save their lives. Okay? Because life is more valuable than saying, I got to keep my word, so I got to turn you in. So you have to have a hierarchy of values also. And I think what you're saying with the mission, that to you guys was a higher value than where you got the thing or whatever. But I think if somebody knocks on my door and says, are you hiding Jews? No, I'm not. Okay, because their life is worth more than the veracity of my word.
But what I'm going to say is you have had to mentally prepare yourself for that question. That's
by doing
point.
It all your life. That's right. When push comes
to
shove, you're going
to
pass
the test. Builds up to that, but builds up to it. Mm-hmm. But no, so when I, you know, most of us, it's like, if I lose my job, I lose everything, okay? The consequences of that are very significant. Mm-hmm. So you have to ask yourself ahead of time, if I ever get in that situation where I have to choose. Now, there's little lies. There's the little things, that, like I said, to accomplish the mission. But
this was a
boundary. This was a line I didn't want to cross. Okay.
Omission.
I mean, there was corruption going on there, and it wasn't by the colonel. It was by the subordinates underneath him. And I didn't, you know, I had to tolerate it because I didn't have a choice, but I wouldn't participate in it. However, when I'm now confronted with confessing about it, the consequences could end my career. That didn't, but we knew it did, and that's what caused the other guy not to testify, is he was worried about the consequences of it, because I've already wargamed it through my mind. No, you know, because I what he came up to tell me validated that debate I'd already had beforehand. If I have to choose between living the rest of my life, you know, going, okay, my career ended here because I chose to do the right thing, or living the rest of my life going, I succeeded because I was a moral coward. And I'm like,
can I choose between the two?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you an honorable man?
No.
I disagree.
Depends on who you talk to. Are you talking to my wife?
I disagree.
No.
I'm talking between you and me.
I mean, varying degrees.
I'm not going to brag. I'm
not
talking about
you
a perfect. I'm not talking about a perfect man. Okay, I do. Been your priest for many years. You were honorably discharged because you served our country with honor.
Right.
And
okay,
see,
that's
there
one
are
thing.
Some people that are dishonorable, and you know, whatever the situation presents to them, it's all about ego. And so
no,
the decisions
I'm gonna tell you,
made,
right.
Mm-hmm.
There are times, all right, there are things I'm honorable, that honor means a lot to me. Friendship means a lot to me, okay? But there are other things I don't think, you know, it's like that's not important to me, okay? I may lie about that, okay, because it doesn't mean anything to me, all right? That's where I probably pushed the bar or whatever. So
I didn't
you
say
you're me,
perfect,
no,
man.
I'm,
I
do
you
not
honorable.
Want to say I'm an honorable man. Look, I am not, I, you know, when you ask me
so
if I'm a Christian.
Why did you take your certificate that said you were honorably discharged if you're not an
because
honor,
I was
nothing,
honorably discharged, okay? That's a different thing.
Because you're an honorable man.
You can be a dishonorable person and still get an honorable discharge.
No,
that honorable
I don't
discharge
agree.
Does not mean you're an honorable person. It means you weren't. You didn't get in trouble.
You served with honor. You served with honor. You didn't disgrace yourself, your family, or your country.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
No, we have to look at no one's perfect but Jesus.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
I go to confession regularly because we are all sinners. Okay? But
right. Like I said, if anybody asks me, are you Christian? My response is, I'm a sinner saved by grace. That's it.
That's
I'm
right.
a sinner.
So am I.
Sinner saved
so
by
am
grace.
I.
Yeah.
So right. am I. Same thing. But see, there are certain people, and I won't mention names in the political realm, because you mentioned the word corruption, they're not honorable. I had one of my children ask me some questions about a specific person, and I said, they're not an honorable person, okay? Mm-hmm. I remember having a book. It was written by Robert Kennedy, I believe, and it said, you know, politics, an honorable profession. And, you know, we've seen so many dishonorable people, even in the military, in the priesthood, okay? But we have to distinguish. Rich, I have a trust in you. James, I know you're honorable men. If I gave you $100 and I said 2 weeks later, hey, you got my $100, I don't think you're going to say, oh, no, you only gave me $90.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
See, the thing is,
okay.
I can say that's conditional. I'm honorable to you, but am I honorable to everybody?
You're honorable before God because you know he's looking. He's watching.
Mm. I'm a sinner. I'm a sinner saved by grace.
Yes, you are.
Okay. That's
and
my
so
response
I.
to that one.
Uh-huh. So am I. You know, we're all sinners, you know. And when we think, the Bible says, if you think you stand, you know, you better be aware of the fact lest you fall. So there's no arrogance here, okay. But when it comes to when you taught the students, for instance, in my wife's school, I can recommend you because I know you're an honorable man with an honorable history and a background, just like all of us, of sin, but you've been forgiven. But you're not going to put just anybody in a place with children, with young people, if they're not honorable, if they have wrong motives. So, you know, you don't see yourself as clearly as other people see you. And you know when a person's an honorable person, not perfect, not completely honest. You know, there's a sin of omission. You know, there are things we should have done we didn't do. That's a sin too, okay? Maybe we didn't, you know, intervene in a situation or whatever it might be that we might be ashamed of. But it doesn't mean we don't have honor. Let me tell you, this is how you know whether you're honorable or not. If you can show honor, it's because you're honorable. If you can show respect, it's because you're respectable. Doesn't mean you're perfect. Paul said he was the chief of sinners. But we have to make a distinction, and I think the Army does. If someone gets discharged dishonorably, it's because they did not serve their country with honor.
Well, I'm a big fan of David where it comes to his lifestyle, okay? Yeah.
I would say he's an honorable man.
Yeah, overall, but I mean, he lied.
Yeah.
Okay, he
lied. Oh, he did.
It was like,
he did a lot
I'm
of
looking
things.
At him like, you know, see, when we're talking about lying, it's like under any situation. And then we learned, mm-hmm. like, well, if you're being tortured, if you're being interrogated by the enemy, it is okay to lie. I'm
mm-hmm.
like, okay,
right.
Well, that's it. And we have social lie where, you know, you know,
yeah,
hey,
does this dress
you
make
like
me look
food.
Fat?
Yeah, that, no,
you
that
know
social lie is.
Does this dress make me look fat?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a social lie. Like, right, yeah. Yeah, I'd rather, I'll say, no, it doesn't. So I don't get beat up. That's
good
right.
To
that's
me.
A social lie.
Good to
right.
me.
Yeah, there are a number of circumstances where lying is the best option. You're right. I was going to say the one we were taught is when someone cooks a meal for you, did you like the meal? You have to say, yes, I did. Okay, but yeah, does this dress make me look fat? No, it doesn't. Yeah, but no, I guess,
etiquette, right?
I guess the thing is that, you know, you can't take it back. All, you know, every decision you're going to make, you can't take it back. It's going to haunt you, all right?
Mm-hmm.
The consequences
That's right.
of everything you do that hurts somebody else. Okay, so I interviewed mm-hmm. one of my classmates, and we're coming up on our 50th anniversary, all right? And so they want a history written, and I'm writing about Grenada, and one of my classmates was Black Hawk, and it was a disastrous thing. It was so hastily thrown together, and it's like all the warrant officers are going, "Hey, this is a suicide mission," and so they go in there, and it was two flights of four helicopters and a diamond. My classmate is the company commander's in the first chalk. He's in the last chalk. And, the next two chalks, the company commander goes in right. The next two chalks come in, and it's too tight. Their blades overlap. They're going to crash. He quickly flares to the right and slams into the ground. And he hit so hard that his blades cut the main shaft of the tail rotor, and all the lights are green. He picks up, and he starts spinning. They're used to the 82nd. They don't get up. When they get helicopter, they don't get up until a bird is lifted. The Rangers used to a touch and go. They jump off and then start running. And so because of the helicopter landed, one of them got decapitated, but his co-pilot on the left in shock. So when they start spinning, he says, "Shut down the engine." This guy just froze. And so they crash landed, which killed more Rangers. Okay. So, but none of this is like his fault. I mean, I'm sitting there going like, yeah, this is out of your control. Okay. But having been, I told him, I said, "Look, I was my first IED attack, all because, we're going up the most heavily ambushed road in Iraq, which is SWORD. James can tell you all about it. SWORD, okay. I happened to mention to the convoy commander when I learned the route. I said, "I've never seen SWORD. I write all about it." He's like, "Hey, you want to ride up front?" Well, that lead gun truck is the one the enemy has been targeting. They take out the lead gun truck, and it usually drives 100 to 200 yards ahead. It's scouting for IEDs, and you don't question things. If they ask you, like, "Hey, okay, I will." That night, they changed their tactics, and they decided to hit the second vehicle, which is the one I normally ride in. Okay, now, I was telling my classmate, I said, "I am really thankful that the IED was on the left side of the road, not my side, because I'd be beating myself up, because it would be, oh, I wasn't trained for the job, whatever. All we're doing is calling out trash. Hey, box on the right, box on the left." No one saw the wires. The driver was on the left side. He just beat himself, and everybody tried to tell him, "Look, you called it out. You're like, you're okay. You called it out." But there's this people got hurt because you didn't identify the ID in that box, okay? I'd be that. So I asked my classmate. I said, "How do you feel?" And he was honest. He said, "Yeah." He said he was going along really good. And then all of a sudden, boom, that PTSD hit him. And it's interesting how it hit him. And then he finally went to see consultation, and then it was over. But my point is, like, we're now dealing with, like, physical decisions, stuff like that. But when we go through life, our moral courage, the thing I regret, it's like when I meet my maker, when I said there, all the people I have hurt that I wanted to hurt, I still have no regrets for it. In fact, most of the time I reflect on it, I didn't hurt them enough, okay? But it's the people I hurt who I did not want to hurt, who expected more from me than I was willing to give them. And things I did that unintentionally hurt them, that is what bothers me. And so,
but Rich, that's where forgiveness comes in. I have people.
No, I know that. I know that. But I'm trying to get to the moral.
I can't forgive myself, but if God
forgives
me.
No, I got it. I got it. So you're saying that I can be a moral coward because I'm going to be forgiven? That's what you're telling me?
I'm telling you that
I can make bad decisions. I can be a moral coward.
You can make reparations. Listen, I have, and I can't divulge, I have heard heinous things in confession. And there are reparations. People can do things to, we call it penance. Like you break a window and you're forgiven, but then you got to pay for the repair of that window. And there are people that have done things and they can in this life begin to make amends. Okay? And people will say, well, I can't forgive myself. Well, if Jesus paid the ultimate price on the cross, if he can forgive you, are you more righteous than him? I understand guilt. I understand peeling it like an onion, the process. But we have to tell people. I had a friend that was a gunner, Marine Corps, 19 years old, killed a lot of people, and he couldn't go into church for 10 years. You might even know him. I used to teach with him at the T school. And until he met a preacher, as he would say, and he prayed a prayer and had forgiveness, and he was a wonderful man, wonderful man. And but then you spend the rest of your life doing good because you've been forgiven, not because you're trying to pay God back or you're trying to earn your salvation. But everybody makes mistakes, and if you can't forgive yourself, you know, I remember counseling a guy. He was a graduate of Annapolis. And there were a couple of leaders that had the church kind of blow up in their face. And I was able to help one guy up and get him involved in my church as a leader. But this guy, he wanted to pull me down with him. He wouldn't let me pull him up. He contemplated suicide and told his children this. You see, if you want to sit in the puddle, you've got to get up, even if you did fratricide or something that you're ashamed of. And God can forgive every sin, but then you spend time doing stuff. Let's say you killed somebody by accident in a drunken driving accident. You got to spend the rest of your life educating people. And as we said about that one general who was not very proficient, all those people got killed. We said he should have gone around and raised money for the families of the people. Not like you're paying for your sin, but we call it penance and reparation in the sense that you're trying to make amends. And so, look, you're going to have a moral failure. You're going to have a physical, as far as moral courage, failure. But it doesn't mean that you have to stay defeated the rest of your life. Do something about it now. You know, I know a lot of alcoholics and drug addicts that I worked with. And now they're helping other people once they got – you know, once they got taken care of themselves.
All right, so you just defeated the whole argument. So we're talking about moral courage and why you need moral courage. What you've just said is you don't need moral courage because you can be forgiven for this.
I didn't say
that. No, you just
if
said
you
it.
Have a,
you just said it.
No, listen to me.
I can
if
do
you
anything
have a
I
failure,
want. I can be a moral coward, and I will be forgiven
Rich,
for it.
Rich, you're exaggerating what I'm saying.
No, I know I am because you cut me off. No, I'm exaggerating because you cut me off. You didn't let me explain that why we need to be moral.
Forgive me, I'm sorry.
We have to have moral courage is so we don't have to wrestle with that guilt. What you're describing is all these people.
What about you do? You have to know what to do.
What?
If you did fail yourself and your team, you have to have some coping mechanism to deal with it.
Wait. I got that. I'm talking about before that. What I'm talking about is before we get to that failure. How do we avoid that failure? Is we've already gone it through. We've already faced that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
but
that's what I'm trying to say.
That it happens, in the event that it
yeah,
happens.
Yeah, we know that. We know there are things that happen. I know I am forgiven for the people I hurt that I didn't hurt. I am forgiven, but it still bothers me, okay?
Sure.
But the thing is...
But it doesn't mean that your perception is 100% right. Sometimes people think and they blame themselves for things that they had no power over, like in the story you shared with us. Go through life with that regret when you had no control over.
All right,
you're
so
not God.
Let's go back to Honduras. Okay, so my friend who lacked moral courage can be forgiven for this. Okay, he's haunted by it. The thing is, he came up to me, he saw me, and he approached me, and he wanted to let me know that I was right and he was wrong. Okay. Now, the fact is, that validates my decision, and I am so grateful for it, because I'd already thought it through. If I get put in that compromising situation, I know what I'm going to do. Now, in his case, he has to accept forgiveness. He has to accept forgiveness. Now, let's ask this question, okay? All right, so what I have found is that when we sin, when we do this,
Cadet
will not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. But then we get in the Army and we find out, no, we got to move that bar. We got to move that bar a little bit, because I will not lie, cheat, or steal for personal gain. But whatever it comes to getting the mission accomplished is fair game, because the rules are designed to prevent you from accomplishing the mission. That's the problem. When you get in the Army, you realize, actually, there was one guy who was interviewed. Oh, the helicopter pilot, he said, his battalion commander told him, never let bureaucracy get in the way of accomplishing the mission. Okay?
But everything,
all these Army rules
the mission,
are designed to keep
right?
you from being able to be succeeded.
Everything
now, the thing is,
the
you
mission.
Move that.
When I had to do services in the field, and we had a mission, I just talked to a colonel friend of mine, chaplain. He was in 82nd, 173rd, the whole nine yards. And I had certain soldiers that couldn't worship on a certain day or whatever. The mission takes priority. Okay? So I'm in some way violating my Christian commitment. But I have to understand, when I signed a dotted line, that nothing trumps the mission. And so I had to tell the soldier, look, I'm sorry, you can't worship on a certain, it's mission essential. So think about whether you want to go into the military. I had this conversation not too long ago. Roger.
James, I think you're wanting to take this conversation someplace else.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. So you know, we're talking about moral courage here, and there takes a level of moral courage. Let's talk a little bit about corruption. And I want to talk, you know, just briefly, give you a couple of incidents here where this is really eroded into, you know, politics. Obviously, you know, everyone knows there's a nastiness in many politicians, and they sell out when they get to a certain point. And there's usually money involved. You know, money, the love of money is what corrupts them. And as there's nothing wrong with a person being successful and making money legally, and you know, and there's no ties to it. But I just want to bring this to your attention. So we have a gubernatorial race heating up here in our state, West Virginia, and it could be anywhere in America. Anywhere this could happen. But we have an individual. He's an attorney general right now. His name's Patrick Morrissey, and he has a very good record for being, or what appeared to be a good record for, you know, being morally straight. However, and this is actually something that came out years ago, but it's really coming back to surface, and it's worse now. The gentleman's married to a woman who is a founding partner of a Washington lobbying firm called Capital Counsel. Counsel has been under investigations for many years, to include, you know, we all know about the opioid issue that we had that led to fentanyl. So I tell people this, and this is the way that I feel, and this is the way that science feels, is that many people were, you know, put on a pill for pain. And when, you know, finally the law came down and says, whoa, we're giving out way too many of these, you know, whatever it is, Percocets or you name it, we got to cut them off. So they cut these folks off. So what do? They go to the illegal, more illicit drugs. I think this creates a problem. And this same group was under investigation for lobbying for the pharmaceutical companies, which now are targets. The funny thing about it is that Mr. Morsi, as an attorney general, has sued the same companies that his wife lobbied for and made millions lobbying for. So you take an individual who is married to a woman. You can't be married to a person and not know what they're doing. If you are a, you know, in a position of politics, this is exactly what I see happening to these folks. They hedge their
bets. Wait. You said he sued the organization his wife works for?
He sued the companies that she lobbied for. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So wait. Let me turn this around. So just,
hold on a second.
You know,
before
you
do that, hold on a second, Rich. Let me go through this real quick here. So now as Attorney General running for governor, another association comes up. So he's the Attorney General. His wife's lobbying for the companies that push the, you know, that push the opioids onto the streets of West Virginia. Now he's going to come in. They've already made the money from the pharmaceutical companies. Now he's going to make the money from suing. Now, not personally, but he won an election and got reelected by it. Now here we see the same guy that is supposedly pro-life, supposedly pro-Second Amendment, and maybe he is personal or maybe he thinks he is in his mind. But the same company that his wife is not just a working for, but is a part, one of the largest owners in this company. So she essentially owns the company. She owns a large share of it. They go out and they lobby with the anti-gun group Gliffords Law Center, which paid them $1 million to the Morsi's firm since 2017. And then they filed a lawsuit against the NRA, citing their support of President Trump's campaign. So they sued not only the NRA, but they sued them because they supported Donald Trump. Now, this same guy, so understand this, you know, well, I understand that there's some, you know, I've lived in a household where my grandmother was a Democrat and my grandfather was a Republican. We had some lively conversations, but at no time did they actively work in an area that benefited on one thing that the other didn't believe in. It was a mutual relationship and agreement. It's not just coming together for a marriage of convenience. These folks have been married for a while. So,
all right. So
hold on a second. Then we're gonna chat it out. I've got very little left here. So Capital Counsel has now received over $2 million from the pro-abortion organization Planned Parenthood. Prior to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood was responsible for approximately 41% of the abortions. And while serving as Attorney General, Patrick Morsi has been involved in litigations defending a state law that restricts abortions. So here's what I'm saying. You have a guy that's running as a Republican and a conservative, he's pro-Second Amendment. This is all the things that he pushes. But he's financially benefiting from the organizations through his wife. At the same time, he's fighting against those same organizations that's putting money in his wife's pockets to include the sum of $55,000 that was donated to his campaign, all from this money that came from these lobbyist activities. It is, I've never seen anything like it. So it's kind of got me a little bit perplexed. So, and then we're gonna talk it up because it is so, so bizarre.
All right.
They're making money on both ends is what I'm saying. It's like no matter who wins or who loses.
That's one perspective. That's your perspective. All right. Let me point out, not everybody has the same marriage, the relationship as you and Heather and Rob and Kate, okay? Like I said when we brought them on, most marriages are marriages of compromises, okay? So for whatever reason, they join together and they have different opinions. So, all right, what you've said is, so the husband is a conservative Republican. The wife is a liberal Democrat. She's taking money. Oh, yeah, he's benefiting because
no,
of
no,
money.
No, no, no. She's a registered Republican.
Well, the thing, okay, so she is.
A wolf and sheep's clothing.
Like, is he personally taking the money from these other organizations?
Yes.
Or is she taking the money?
She's taking the money, and then she's donating
right.
it to him.
Right, he's not.
The attorneys are donating. It,
but yeah,
benefiting money
him
law.
And stuff like that. My point is, look, James, I'm just going to tell you. All right, let's just start this out. All I know is what you've just told me. So every time I say something and you reveal something different,
right,
that changes the conversation, which means you have not told me everything. So every time you reveal something new means you have concealed information I don't know.
No. It's not that at all. It's the fact that
Yes, it is. If I present something and you present something you have not presented before, you have concealed that
I was trying to explain the whole detail to you.
Go ahead.
I was trying to explain the details to you. What I'm talking about here.
Go ahead.
Is what is morally correct. If we're talking about moral courage, let me explain to you how I feel about this. When I was
I know what you feel. I don't have a lot of time because we're getting now close to like 10 minutes.
Okay. I want to point out, let me say this,
and I'll take like 2 minutes to say it.
All right.
Okay.
You're on the clock.
Yes. Okay. So you can have, look, I'm married to me and my wife. We agree on a lot of things, but there's a lot of things we don't agree on. Okay. And she has a sign that, you know, the opinions of the husband do not reflect the those of the management. Okay.
Right.
Right. Okay. The thing is, it works the other way around. So you can run for politics and be a conservative and be, you know, pro-life and all that, and be married to a woman who is mm-hmm. the opposite of it, okay? And she's taking money from organizations that in order to try to influence you.
Right.
Does that mean you lack moral courage? Because your wife is getting paid by organizations that are contrary to your beliefs.
Okay. Let me tell you where this comes into play.
Now I render the floor.
Now, let me tell you where this comes into play. You don't just elect a governor or a president. You also elect a first lady. And when you're looking at hiring somebody to lead your state, you're not just going to be putting one person in the governor's mansion or the White House. You're putting them both in there. And they both have roles to play. And in this situation, these are very conflicting roles. And in addition to that, I do say that he lacks moral courage, because if he had any moral courage and he really believed in what he was saying, he wouldn't take one penny from an organization or an individual knowing where that money come from. No matter how many times you wash blood money. And I consider all abortion money blood money. No matter how many times you wash it, it's no good. And you cannot consciously call yourself pro-life or pro-Second Amendment if you're taking even a penny of a donation or a whatever you want to call it,
Wait. Hold on. Let me correct that. All right. Just one thing.
Yeah.
Or when you're saying, is he taking the money or is his wife taking the money? No.
Yes.
There's no yes. Is he taking the money or is his wife taking the money?
He's taking them as campaign contributions. Yes. That's a fact.
Well, then that's different. But you're talking about his wife. Okay. You're electing his wife. You're saying when you vote for a governor, voting for his wife. In his opinion. Okay.
You're voting. So when
it's going into his war chest.
That's right. Yes. There you go. Going into his war chest. Father Michael, what's your thoughts on that? I just sent you all the stories too, by the way.
There's an inconsistency and a duplicity. I see this in police officers when I give them training. You can't be two-faced. That's a lack of integrity. Integrity is integration. It's inconsistent behavior. It's duplicity. It is corruption. Kind of like, you know, the president has said he knew nothing about anything his son was doing. When you're that close in relationship with one another, it's really naive for them to think that we can really believe the fact that they know nothing about what the other person is doing. Now, they might conceal some stuff, but for the most part, no, it's an inconsistency. You mentioned it in our earlier conversation. It's hypocrisy. You say one thing and do another. Oh, personally, I'm against it, but I'm not going to impose my feelings on the others. Well, if you're against it, you violated your conscience. If you can violate your conscience.
Wait. No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about a wife. We're talking about a wife.
But
is taking money, not the guy. Has he ever changed his position on anything, regardless of what his wife says or the
let
money
me explain
she's
to you. So there's another report that's out there. Okay, that came through.
Oh, you're bringing something else up that you have concealed from me in this discussion.
Nobody's concealing anything. We don't have much time, so I'm just saying I'm giving it to you in bits and pieces because you know we were debating moral courage. So the moral courage, the issue here is that yes, he has not went after organizations that he probably should have went after, and we have settled for financial agreements, especially in some of these companies.
You didn't bring that up.
Well, it's why I sent it to you. I all I can do is send you the information as quick as I can.
No, you didn't send anything to me.
I texted it to you guys. I just texted it to you. You know, I texted it to you. But the point that I'm making is that, yes, your wife is going to be living in the governor's mansion. Your wife is going to be living in the White House. This is the point that Americans need to understand. If we would have looked a little bit deeper, maybe, I doubt it, because the Democrats just hated Trump so much they were going to – the devil could have ran and they would have voted for the devil. But I think that some Americans that were suckered in to voting for this guy, if they really knew the depths of how his son was, I don't think that many of them would have voted for him based on his guilty by association and the
all
fact
right.
that
– No. That – All right, because what we're finding is it's the Biden family. It's not a corrupt son. It's like Billy Carter. I mean, Jimmy Carter, he's a great ex-president. He was a moral man. His brother, Billy Carter, was an idiot. Okay? You can't judge Jimmy Carter by Billy Carter. All right, now let me tell you. My wife, all right, we agree on a lot of things. But there's things we don't agree on. She is extremely jealous. But Jella, you know she's been jealous of you, all right? If it's up to her, you and I would not be friends, and I would not be going to your church. She's been jealous of Aikido. If it's up to her, I would have had to give Aikido up a long time ago. About moral courage, there are certain things I have said. No, I've told her. I will, you know, you, if it comes between you and divorce, you and Aikido, pack your fucking bag. If it comes between you and my friend, pack, listen, pack your fucking bag. That's the discussion. Man. All right. So now when you're talking about a governor, you're saying this governor is morally weak and will not, even though his wife has differing opinions, and we're not all Kate and Rob. We don't have the perfect marriage. We haven't found our soulmate where mm-hmm. we're perfectly aligned. We compromised and married someone we have something in common with, but we don't agree on everything. And because she disagrees with my political opinions, that means I have been compromised. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, Araceli has not compromised me on my moral values.
But you can't say that the wife doesn't influence. Now I'm thinking of Samson and Delilah.
There
is some influence. I mean, let's be frank, gentlemen.
All right. When you and I had that discussion.
They can tame the man. Believe me.
Hold on, Rich. Let him finish.
I've been married 47 years, okay, and I have a very good marriage. You can't tell me that my wife doesn't have influence. Not to make me compromise for the gospel, okay, or anything like that, but you can't say that a wife doesn't have some
power. Your wife, you're married to a good woman. Okay, I know. She has a lot of influence on you. Seriously, look, Father Michael.
Yes?
You would be nothing without your wife. I know you. Okay, I'm telling you, folks, I go over there, I spent time with them, I then like, you know, when you see the people who are so well connected that when one dies, within a year, the other dies, that's what I fear. I constantly pray for Doreen because I know if we lose Doreen, I'm going to lose one of my closest friends. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I got that. Okay. But that's not every marriage. All right.
Yeah. But the thing is that you really do I want to make this point very clear. You don't hear about the spouse of congressmen or senators, but you darn sure see them when they're governors and whenever they're the president. And the influence that Jill Biden and Michelle Obama has had on policy and this country. And let's just go with Hillary Clinton now. There have been three women.
You want to know the most influential wife? Eleanor Roosevelt. Even after her husband died, she was a power influencer.
Yep. Probably while he was alive.
But the thing was is that she was complimentary to him. You know what I mean? They weren't clashing. It wasn't like she was out making money off, she was supporting the efforts of her husband.
Got it. Okay, so here's where we are. All right. So
but I sent you those stories, by the way.
No, I know. Essentially, the debate is this. How much influence does our wives have on us? How
Not
strong
ours.
Is our... No, no, no.
Not
How
ours.
Strong?
A first lady? Hours. A first lady is what I'm talking about. This
No. I'm talking about all men. I'm talking all men
but,
right
no,
now.
I don't
want to
go there.
President.
We don't have time to go there.
Rich, when I went more liturgical, Doreen was not in agreement. It's taken a long time for God to convince her, and I gave some teaching, but I just did what I felt God wanted me to do, and she's followed along. But she came kicking and screaming, okay? And so we have to do what we know we're going to give an account to God for. And so in that case, I have to be the leader in my home.
All right.
But certainly
okay.
in other things as well.
Yeah.
I'm just going to make this one statement. All right. Mm-hmm. Based on my wife, I'm never going to judge a man on his wife.
Rich, you got a great wife. We all love her here. You got a great wife, Rich. Hello? Did I lose you guys?
Looking out for you.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad you like her.
Hey, Father Michael, let's close us out in prayer. We got 4 minutes left. What do you say?
Very good. All right. Thank you. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, Lord, we know that we're all weak and sinful men. We know that we need your grace. And, Lord, we don't want to be judgmental, but we want to show good judgment. Help us to be examples. Lord, we want leaders who can lead us by their example. I thank you for this conversation. I pray that you'll help us and you'll bless our country because it's in a real mess, Lord. We need you, and I just thank you, Lord, for this discussion tonight. For I pray in Jesus' name, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen.
Yeah, that was a beautiful prayer.
James, can I say something real quick?
Oh, my goodness, yes, absolutely.
We're moving our mission, and we've been looking for a place, and any of our friends out there that pray, I would appreciate. We have some possibilities, and it's really, we got about a month before we're out of this place because we need more room, but I would just ask to pray because that's really heavy on my heart.
Well, yeah, so you're moving out because your congregation's growing, right?
Yes, yes, and we need
a problem to have.
And I think we'll grow more in a bigger place as well in a different location, but you know, we just need the right place. There's some possibilities, but I just wanted to mention that because I know there are those on the show who do pray, and it's important.
Absolutely, folks. Anytime that we can pray for each other, we should do that. We definitely need to pray for this country and for our states and the things that are going on right now. You know, I really pray that that DeSantis and Trump can bury the hatchet and not in each other's skulls and can come together. Imagine what a team that would make if you had one running as president and one run. It would be a clean sweep across the board if you had both of those go into office. I think that our country needs good, strong, godly leaders. I don't think I know it. We know it. We've been the victim of, and you've talked about this as well, about, you know, we've been just emasculated. I mean, it's just, you know, the manhood has been torn into this freak show that you see going on now. And women who, you know, were enjoying some of this in the beginning, now are seeing, well, this is what's happened. Now we've got men dressed up as women that are now competing in the supports that they fought so hard to get. Anyways,
title
we've got
nine.
A minute left.
Yeah.
Rich, you got any parting comments? Like, tell your wife.
Hey, go to Amazon. Go to Amazon. Type in Kill Blaine. Look up my books. Filthy 13 is still very popular, but the They Were the Rough Riders is as I would say better written than the Filthy 13. Okay.
Good.
So if you want a very entertaining read that makes you put you in the position of the soldiers that are going through that experience, go look up that book and buy it.
Yeah, same thing with Father Pacella. Give him a shout out for where to find your book at, Father Michael.
Yeah, Amazon, From Valor to Virtue, The Moral Development of the Brave. And then there's another book called God Was Not Silent, which I wrote with Dr. John Stanko. Amazon.
Okay. All right.
God bless, folks. We're off the air now. We'll see you next Friday.
Good night.
Thanks a lot, guys. Good night.
Bye-bye.